at the end of summer camp, we have a survey that goes out to the campers. And at Camp Davidson every year, they have a survey. I didn't see the surveys last year, but the two previous years, I was able to go through with the other ministers and camp staff what the campers had put down on their surveys. And one of the survey questions at the very end concerned Bible study topics and what subjects they would like to have taught in the Bible studies at camp and even hear more about in local churches and on youth weekends. And I'll give you just a quick quiz. How many think you know what the number one topic both of those years is that the youth, the campers, put down as a topic they want to hear more about at camp? That's what? And that's it, prophecy. So we got a, do we have a prize, a first prize winner of some kind, a flower or something? So, you know, it really surprised us. We thought, you know, they would want more about relationships and, you know, marriage and dating and, you know, all those other things. But really, they wanted to know more about prophecy. In fact, several were very concerned that, you know, they really wanted to know which booklets to start with and how to get a good foundation in the subject. So I thought today I might at least try to help a little bit in that way. I want to discuss a term that is used in the Bible to refer to three different time periods, but I want to focus on the second. So if you are a title writer, some of you like to write titles down on your notes, that's fine. The title of today's sermon is Joseph and the Last Days. Joseph and the Last Days. Now, the term last days refers to several different things in the Bible. You can have to turn there, but in Acts chapter 2 and verse 17, there's a quote that the Apostle Peter is quoting out of Joel chapter 2. It says, "It shall come to pass in the last days, says God, I'll pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, your young men shall see visions, your old men shall dream dreams." So Peter is saying this visions of the last days that was prophesied by Joel is beginning in the year probably 31 AD. So in that case, the term last days would begin at 31 AD and then end at the return of Jesus Christ. So, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 years. Also over in Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 2, there is a phrase called the last days. But this last days refers to a much shorter period of time. In fact, I think we would all agree that it's condensed down to about the last 3.5 years or very close to it of the entire chronology of mankind since the beginning of Adam. So in Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 2, "It shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of all the mountains and shall be exalted above it." That's obviously when Christ returns. So this phrase, last days, in Isaiah chapter 2, refers to a time right when Christ returns, and perhaps refers to the entire millennium. But certainly Isaiah is referring to a last days phrase that is after Christ returns, or at the time of Christ's imminent return. Now there's another phrase of the last days that is a lot more difficult to understand. And I'm hoping to help you understand what that is today. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 48. Genesis chapter 48. In this case, there's another phrase called the last days mentioned. And this last days is very, let's just say it's not very difficult, but it takes more of a discerning understanding of prophecy to know exactly what he's talking about here. And since the vast majority of the world has lost sight of these events and what they mean in Genesis 48 and 49, they simply gloss over this and completely misunderstand what it says, believing that all of these things apply only to the son named Judah, not to all the sons of Israel. Let's start at Genesis chapter 48, beginning in verse 1. "It came to pass after these things that one told Joseph, behold, your father is sick. He took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, with him." So we are in Egypt. The sons of Israel have gone down there many years before because of the famine. They became really landowners down there, became part of the fabric of the land of Egypt. And now, of course, Jacob is about to die. And his son, Joseph, whom he loved very much, was going to come to him with his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. "One told Joseph," or Jacob, "and behold, your son Joseph comes unto you. And Israel strengthened himself and sat upon the bed." So Israel, name was changed to Israel from Jacob, sat upon his bed, and he said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan. This is, by the way, the same area as Jacob's well. There you're known as Shechem. That's where he saw this just ladder with the angels going back and forth up and down to heaven. And he said unto me, behold, I'll make you fruitful and multiply you. I will make of you a multitude of people, very large nation. I will give this land to your seed after you for a possession. Now this blessing that he's referring to here does not refer to a crown, does not refer to a kingship. It refers to the blessings of large nations and a land flowing with milk and honey, a land that would be very productive. Verse 5, now unto your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, which were born unto you in the land of Egypt before I came to you into Egypt, they are mine as Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. So here now we have Israel adopting these two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, as his firstborn, because Reuben and Simeon were the first two born. Now we have the firstborn replaced by Ephraim and Manasseh. This is incredibly significant that the promise of the blessing, the birthright blessing, given to Abraham, then passed on to Isaac, and then to Jacob, is not passed on to the firstborn Reuben, but is passed on instead unto these two sons as they are adopted as equal sons here by Israel. Notice verse 6, and your issue, which shall you shall beget after them, shall be yours. So he says, look, Joseph, if you have any more children, any more sons, they are yours. They get your inheritance. But these two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, they get my inheritance. They are now as my firstborn. So it's important to understand what is going on here in this time when Joseph brings his sons to his father who is about to die. Verse 7, and as for me, when I came from Padan, Rachel died by me in the land of Canaan. Now Rachel was the mother of Joseph and also of Benjamin. She died in childbirth to Benjamin. In the way, and there was but a little way to come to Ephraim or Ephrath. I buried her there in the way of Ephrath, the same is Bethlehem. So that's where they have the sepulchre to this day of Rachel. And Israel beheld Joseph's sons and said, who are these? So Joseph said to his father, they are my sons whom God has given me in this land. And he said, bring them, I will bless them. Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age, so that he could not see. And he brought them near unto him, he kissed them and embraced them. So he's there essentially passing on his inheritance to these two sons that were grandsons, but are now to be given the blessing of the firstborn. Israel said to Joseph, I had not thought to see your face, and lo, God has showed me also your seed. So Joseph brought them out from between his knees. So they must have been maybe 5, 6, 7 year olds. They were youngsters. Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand towards Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand towards Israel's right hand, and brought them to him. So Joseph wanted Manasseh, the oldest, to be blessed with the right hand. He understood the significance of the two hands and of which one was to be the firstborn and which one was to be second. Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it upon Ephraim's head, who was younger. So he crossed his hands, his left hand upon Manasseh's head, guiding his hands wittingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. Now, how did he know to do that? It's anybody's guess. No one knows. The Bible doesn't tell us. Another one of these unanswered questions. I would assume God appeared to him in a dream, or he just somehow knew that the blessing, the greater blessing, should be given to the secondborn, not the first. He blessed Joseph and said, God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac did walk, the God which fed me all my life long unto this day, the angel which has redeemed me from all evil. And of course, he means the messenger of God, the one who later became Jesus Christ, the angel or the agent of God. Bless these lads, let my name be named upon them. So the people of Israel are to be called by his name, and that name was to be upon these descendants, these two men. And the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. So they were to be a large nation, a large peoples. And when Joseph saw his father had his right hand upon the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. He held his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. He said, uh-oh, Dad's making a mistake. He's got his hands crossed here. I've got to change it. Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this is the firstborn, pointing out to Manasseh. Put your right hand upon him. But his father refused, and said, I know it, my son, I know it. He shall also become a people, and he shall also be great, but truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations. And so he blessed them that day, saying, and you shall Israel bless, God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh, and he said, Ephraim before Manasseh. And Israel said to Joseph, behold, I am dying. So he was old, he knew he was dying. God shall be with you and bring you again to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given to you one portion above your brethren, which I took out of the hand of the Amorites with my sword and my bow. So he said, the land that was given to me, the land that God gave to me, I have given a portion above to your two sons. Now, we don't know how much time transpasses between 48 and 49, these chapters in Genesis. It may have been the next day. It may have been, you know, a month or two later. We really don't know. But let's look at chapter 49 now. Here, all 12 of the sons of Israel are gathered before him, from Reuben all the way down to Benjamin. Jacob called unto his sons and said, gather yourselves together, that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days. Now, this term, last days, is not the same as the time after Christ returns. Because as we go through this chapter, we see many of these things that obviously take place when these nations, these people are still nations, and Jesus Christ is not ruling the earth. So the same last days as Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 2 is ruled out. Also, these last days don't count as the time of from 31 AD until Christ returns, because many of these things didn't begin to happen until many centuries later. So the same time period of last days spoken of by Joel and then quoted by Peter is not the same as these last days. In this case, these last day events refer to a time much later. And I'll show you there are two ways in the Bible that we arrive at this. They're pretty accurate, and I hope that after today you're able to explain what this term last days means. He says, gather yourselves together, and hear you sons of Jacob, hearken unto your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn in my might, in the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity, and the excellency of power. But you are unstable as water. You shall not excel, because you went up to your father's bed, and you defiled it. He went up to my couch. Now, these last days that he's referring to here are describing the way these nations are going to be during a certain period of time. Our best conclusion, and I believe there's ample evidence of it, is that this last days begins in about the year 1800 and refers to the last, let's just take a guess here, 220 to 250 years, 240, whatever it might be, before Christ returns. And if you understand what happened to Reuben at about the year 1800, they had just gone through what was called the French Revolution. Now, the French Revolution came right on the heels of the American. The French Revolution began in 1789. The American Constitution was finished in 1787. And the French looked over and said, look, the Americans now have fought this war. Of course, the French helped us. But they had this concept called freedom. And so the French came out with their concept, some of these French revolutionaries, only they didn't call it just freedom. They called it freedom, fraternity, and something else. I forget the third word. It's been a little while since I've studied the French Revolution. What was it? Equality? Yeah, it was libertad, igualdad, and fraternidad or something. I don't speak French other than say parlez-vous français. That's about it. But at any rate, if you want to do a real interesting study of history, look at the vast differences between the American Revolution and the French Revolution. It's very simple. The American Revolution was essentially carried out by religious zealots who wanted to obey God in the way they wanted to obey God. And they wanted to get rid of this heavy hand of King George. Many of the writings of those who were behind the revolution, Samuel Adams and many others, spoke in great disgust at the immorality of the British, at how they were ungodly, how they couldn't worship God. In the American homes of the 1700s, almost every American home had two books. And this is what our American fathers, grandfathers, great-grandfathers were raised on. The first was the Bible. And at nighttime, they didn't have TV. They didn't watch Jay Leno or David Letterman. They sat around. They read the Bible. The second most popular book that was in almost every home in America, anyone know, by the way? I mentioned this before. So you probably know which one is it? Mr. Finnegan? Foxes. Yeah, Fox's Book of Martyrs. Most every American revolutionary, every American child back in the 1700s was raised on the stories of Fox's Book of Martyrs, which is a story or a chronology of people of bravery who stood up because of their principles. So the American Revolution was essentially carried out by very religious people who wanted to obey God in what they felt was the biblical way, without having the shackles of the British Empire and the Church of England on them. This is a very simplistic explanation, but I think it's accurate. The French Revolution was a revolution against the king and against the Catholic Church. They were very upset with Louis XIV, Louis XV, Louis XVI, and of course Marie Antoinette and their excessive, extravagant lifestyles, while the average person lived in squalor and virtually starving. And of course the Catholic priests that had taken so much of the wealth of Europe and especially France for about 1,200 years, when they invented the guillotine, which was supposed to be a very easy, quick, and painless death, I suppose it is, although no one ever came back afterwards to tell anybody what the experience was like. But I believe they guillotined something like 18,000 priests. I wasn't there, but the numbers are certainly very, very high. In the days of the Jacobins and the times of the death, the tribunals and all of that, the French Revolution was a horrible experience for most people in France. And what happened later, of course, was about 100 years of instability. When it says here that rule will be unstable as water, it's a very apt description of what has happened to that nation, to the descendants of Reuben, ever since the year 1800. They had not excelled, except they had a few colonies, tried to beat the British at some naval things, although pretty much they lost. They had to go back and forth from these little tribunals. Finally, of course, the French Revolution completely collapsed, and they had a new emperor crowned named Napoleon, and then he was beaten by the combined forces of the other nations of Europe, and then it went down to the island of St. Helena down in the Atlantic, and finally died there. But Reuben fulfilled this prophecy that begins in about the year 1800, that they have been unstable. They really didn't have any acceleration, you might say, over other nations of the earth. In the 20th century, they lost two wars. If America had not come over in World War I, they would have lost that. They certainly lost very quickly in World War II and have not done very well ever since. In fact, today they go back and forth for a variety of governments, none of which seem to be very stable. Simeon and Levi were to be scattered, verse 5. Drop down a little bit farther. Judah, verse 8. You are to be whom your brethren shall praise. Your hand shall be in the neck of your enemies. So the Jews are in this time, they were resettling back in the land that had been conquered by their enemies, the Muslims. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. So he is able to be a very strong fighter, and when he decides to take over an area, he was able to. My son, you are gone up. He stooped down, couched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up? But then notice verse 10. During this last day, so keep in mind we are still talking about the years that began in about the year 1800, the scepter shall not depart from Judah. So there shall still be a king sitting on the throne. Now when this was spoken in Genesis, we're talking back in Egypt in 1500 BC. I mean, a long time before there ever was a King David or a King Solomon or any sort of scepter actually ruling Israel. So when Jacob said this, God inspired him to just think into the future and to know that there would be a king sitting on a throne, a Judahite sitting on the throne of Israel after these last days begin, or during the time of these last days. So the scepter is still held by Judah. Even though that throne is in the land of Ephraim, it is still the descendants of King David, Judahites, who sit upon that throne. Nor a lawgiver between his feet until Shiloh comes. So until Christ returns, and that, of course, indicates that the end of this last days is when Christ returns. The end of this phrase, last days here, is referred to, would be when Shiloh comes and the gathering of the people would be. So the people are going to be scattered, but there is going to be a king from Judah still holding a scepter during this time called the last times. Binding his foal to the vine, his ass's colt to the choice vine, he washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. Just referring to the fact that Judah continued all down during this time to exist, and even though others were attacking him, others were after him, certainly he was able to continue. Now let's drop down to Joseph. We don't have time to go through the other nations. I think it's not necessarily germane to what we want to talk about today. Verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful bough. Now a bough is a grapevine. You ever planted grapes, they sort of just seem to keep growing. They can just grow and grow and grow and grow. Depending on the type of grapes, but like Concord grapes, some Concord grapevines can seem like they grow into the next county. So Joseph was a fruitful bough. He's continuing to grow and to expand into other areas. Even a fruitful bough by a well, continually watered, whose branches, the word in Hebrew actually means daughters, run over the well. It's been understood to be colonizing and going to other parts of the world. Now the colonizing by the people of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, really took off in about the year 1800, when places all around the world, the continent of Africa, and certainly even places in South America, all of America, of course, had already been colonized, but the Ephraimites were here. Canada, we could go on and name it. The British Empire was by far the largest empire in the history of the earth, as far as empires go. Verse 23, the archers have surely grieved him and shot at him and hated him. You know, Satan, the devil, has fiery darts. And other people tried to stop this expansion. But in his bow, he abode in strength. And the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. And many historians of the British Empire relate supernatural events that took place during their wars, when just by virtual supernatural intervention, they won battles that they should have lost. In fact, you know, the British have, there's a lot of good British jokes. One of the best is not just a joke, it's true. The British are always preparing to win the previous war. And that's why they always get their noses bloody in the first battle of any war they've ever been in. French and Indian War is one good example. World War I is another good example, where all these men who had been schooled in Napoleonic tactics of just massing an army and crushing the enemy's defenses hadn't thought about the concept of the machine gun. And so instead they lost, in the case of the Battle of the Somme, 30,000 Tommies in one morning, and advanced no more than about 10 feet. In fact, a lot of them were killed before they got even to their own lines. So the British have always prepared to win the previous war, which, by the way, I think is a really good lesson for all of us, because a lot of us in God's church, we are never let anybody go teach us about the Trinity ever again. We are determined to win that last war. Well, you know, there's another war coming, and the tactics will be different, and the temptations will be different. So I think it's great that we're never again going to let someone try to force the Trinity or antinomianism, teaching against the law, on us. But that's not what Satan's going to use in the next war, because tactics will have changed, times will have changed, and Satan will have a new idea. So while it's great that we are here and we won the last war, let's not spend all of our time preparing to win that war again, because the war we're going to face in the future is going to be somewhat different. That's been the history of the British Empire, and I think there's a lesson there for Christians. Let's continue down. It says, the mighty hands of the God of Jacob. Notice, from thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. He says the stone of Israel is still going to be well known. Now, most of you understand the history of the stone of Jacob, that when God appeared to Jacob, he was leaning back on this stone. That's how he slept. Now, I've had a couple of beds like that in motels a few times. I know what that feels like. But he had this stone, and it's about, you know, size of a large suitcase today. And he decided to carry it around with him because he was on this stone when God appeared to him. It went with the Israelites down to Egypt. It came back out with them when Moses said, must I strike this rock and get water out of it for you? That stone was there, the stone of Israel. The rock of Israel is mentioned all during the times of Israel's wandering through the wilderness. And it was used to symbolize God's presence. It was a symbol of the angel of God being with them in the presence of the people of Israel. So notice, from thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. So the shepherd of Israel, his presence is symbolized by this stone, which is still today in the keeping of Ephraim and Manasseh. The sons of Joseph have this stone. Now it's up at the castle in Scotland, and most of them have no idea what it really symbolizes, but it is certainly there. And I think it's interesting that in this prophecy about this 200 and some years called the last days, that this stone is mentioned as being in the keeping of the sons of Joseph. Notice verse 25, even by the God of your father, who shall help you, and by the Almighty, who shall bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies under, blessings of the breasts of many, many children being born, blessings of the womb. So during this time, Joseph is to have all these blessings. Blessings of the deep. They're able to transverse the oceans in big ships. Their navies ruled the world. They had many, many children. The blessings of your father have prevailed against the blessings of my progenitors under the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. So all other people would be supplanted or pushed out wherever the descendants of Joseph were to go. Notice they shall be on the head of Joseph, on the crown of the head of him that was separate from his brethren. So during this time, Joseph was to be fruitful. A grapevine that would go all over the wall. He would have in his possession this stone that symbolized the angel of God who came with the people of Israel and gave them protection. Now, let's ask two questions. How do we arrive at the year 1800? Do we just look at history and say, well, you know, about that time we could look at these blessings and see, you know, in retrospect, that's about the time when these things began to take place. Actually, the Bible gives us two witnesses. God always says that he will give us at the mouth of two witnesses to establish something. He gives us two very accurate chronologies in prophecy that tell us, you know, almost not to the year, but to within a few years of when this is going to take place. Let's go to Leviticus chapter 26, beginning in verse 1. Leviticus chapter 26, you all know this as the blessings and cursing section of the Bible. The first 13 verses of Leviticus concern the blessings that God would give Israel when they would come into their own land. And this is also a covenant, meaning that it refers to, or it still applies during the entire history of Israel. Leviticus chapter 26, let's begin in verse 3. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, then I will give you rain in due season. The land shall yield her increase. The trees of the field shall yield their fruit. And your threshing shall reach unto the vintage, and the vintage shall reach unto the sowing time. So you'll still be harvesting crops when it's time to sow again. You'll still be processing the crops you harvested when it's time to harvest some more. Verse 6, I'll give you peace in your land. You shall lie down, none shall make you afraid. I'll rid evil beasts out of the land. Neither shall the sword go through your land, so God would give them peace. You shall chase your enemies, they shall fall before you by the sword. Five of you shall chase 100, and 100 shall put 10,000 to flight, and your enemies shall fall before you by the sword. And this was certainly true in many, many of the times that our forefathers have had battles, not only with a very small American army led by General Washington that defeated the greatest army in history, but then at that time anyway, the greatest army in history up till that time, but also many, many other events that have taken place even since that time. I will have respect unto you and make you fruitful, multiply you, and establish my custom with you. Verse 12, I'll walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. I am the Lord your God, which brought you forth out of the land of Egypt, that you should not be their bondsmen, not be slaves in Egypt. I have broken the bands of your yoke and made you upright. That's the summary of the blessings. Now, the cursings take a lot more verses because God wants them to understand very clearly that they will be cursed if they do these things. So let's start in verse 15. Let's start in verse 14. If you won't hearken to me and do these commandments, if you despise my statutes, if your soul abhors my judgments, so that you will not do my commandments, but you break my covenant. Now, the covenant is still in effect, but they have broken what they agreed to do. I will do this to you. I will appoint over you terror. So a fear, a terror would come across the land. We've seen even some of that in recent times. Consumption and the burning ague, diseases shall consume your eyes and cause sorrow of heart. You shall sow your seed in vain. Enemies shall eat it. I'll set my face against you. You shall be slain before your enemies. They that hate you shall reign over you, and you shall flee when no one pursues. Notice verse 18. If you will not yet for all this hearken unto me, I'll punish you seven times more for your sins. Now the Hebrew word here is intensity, not time. This simply means your punishment will be more intense, seven times more intense than what it has been. I'll break the pride of your power. I'll make your heavens as iron, your earth as brass. Your strength will be spent in vain. Now, if you don't wake up, verse 21, you walk contrary to me, you don't hearken, I'll bring seven times more plagues upon you. Again, seven times more intensity of punishment. Now let's drop down to verse 23. If you will not be reformed by me by these things, if you don't wake up, if you don't listen, if you don't understand that I am going to punish you and these punishments should cause you to wake up, if you don't come back to your God, after all of these warnings, the terror, the consumption, the diseases, and then finally those being intensified, verse 24 says, I will walk contrary to you and will punish you yet seven times for your sins. This is a different word for times. This means time periods. Seven time periods for your sins. This is not intensity. So for seven time periods, they would be punished for all of their sins because of what they've done. Now, most of us understand, or we've gone through the correspondence course in years past, but just to rehearse, let's first turn back to Genesis chapter 7 and verse 11. You can hold your place if you'd like to there, although a lot of people don't like it when I say hold your place somewhere. They want to just, you know, don't want to have their finger get caught in the Bible or something. So, but a year, the word times refers to a year, a number of places. We have time, time, and half a times in Revelation. This word for times can refer to a year very simply. Now the question is asked, how long is a year in Bible prophecy? And the answer is 360 days. In Genesis chapter 7 and verse 11, it says, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, in the 17th day of the month, in the same day all the fountains of the great deep were broken up and the windows of heaven were open. So we begin to have some calendar calculations. You go down to verse 24, the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days. And let's go over to chapter 8 and verse 4. The ark rested in the seventh month, in the 17th day of the month, upon the mountains of Ararat. So in verse 5, we have the waters decreasing. If you put all these calculations together, and we don't have time to go through all of that today, but it's very simple to understand that in the original creation, the time of the flood, a year was 360 days long. And in Bible prophecy, ever since that time, the year is still 360 days long. Now, there are two reasons why a year is now 365 and a quarter days long. Anyone know what those are? I'm going to raise your hand real quick. Yes. You know what they are? What is it? You know what the answer is? Which one? Oh, you want to know why? Okay. There are two reasons why the year is now 365 and a quarter days long when at creation was 360. The first is Joshua's long day. And the second is the dial of Ahaz. Joshua's long day, the earth stood still for 23 and one half hours. Now on a degree dealibop, I mean dealibop, that's a terrible scientific term. You can tell how long it's been since I've been to college. I should have some of our young scholars here come explain this. I have a couple good books on Joshua's long day and the dial of Ahaz. But essentially after Joshua's long day, the earth stood still, but it basically moved out slightly. In the rotation distance away from the sun. The earth was able to keep rotating, but keep having sun on one spot for the Valley of Ahalon. In Joshua's long day, he also shows the moon being in one place and the sun in a certain percentage of degree over the Valley of Ahalon. You read that in the book of Joshua. And it's fairly easy to compute, a number of astronomers have, that the rotation of the earth went a little bit different, or the circulation of the earth around the sun, and the earth then became 365 days around the sun instead of 360. In Joshua's long day, I think it went 366, now it's back to 365 and a quarter, because the dial of Ahaz went back 5 degrees, 5 out of 360. So between those two, because of those two events, a year is now 365 and a quarter days long instead of 360. But a prophetic year is still 360, and we know that from Revelation chapter 12. Let's go over there. Revelation 12 and verse 14. We find that there is still a 360-day year in terms of prophetic computation. So Revelation chapter 12 and verse 14. To the woman were given the wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness and to her place where she is nourished for a time, time, and half a times. And of course, that is 3.5 years, mentioned about 5 other places. So here, times, time, and half a times, those are all referring to years. Each time is a year. It's also 1260 days. So putting that together with chapter 13 and verse 5, which says 42 months, we know the months were 30 days long, and in this case are computed as 30 days long, and the year, the prophetic year, was 360 days long. So here we have then the time when Israel went into captivity. Let's go back over to where we were in Leviticus chapter 26. I said put your finger there, see, and I know at least one of you did that, so that's good. But Leviticus chapter 26. He says very plainly that after the seven times are over, God would remember his covenant with the sons of Joseph, and then it would come to pass, regardless of what they were doing. Verse 43, here in Leviticus chapter 26. The land shall be left of them, and shall enjoy her Sabbaths, while she lies desolate without them. They shall accept of the punishment of their iniquity, because even because they despise my judgments, and because of their soul abhorred my statutes. Notice that. Yet for all that, when they be in the land of their enemies, I will not cast them off. God will not forget the covenant he made with them, even though Israel is being punished for seven times, which is 2,520 years, seven times 360 times the seven times 360 is 2,520. Seven times in 360 days in a year. So for 2,520 years, counting each day for a year, they would be punished. But even when they were in the land of captivity, they had abhorred God. God says, I will not cast them off. Verse 45. I will for their sakes remember the covenant of their ancestors. I'll remember after this 2,520 years is up, the covenant I made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, whom I brought forth out of the land of Egypt, in other words, the sons of Israel, Isaac, Israel and Jacob, in the sight of the heathen, that I might be their God, for I am the Lord. So in verse 45, God promises he'll remember the covenant, and those blessings of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob will be bestowed upon these people, these sons of Israel. Now, they went into captivity. The sons of Israel did in 718 approximately B.C. Let's go to 2 Kings chapter 18. So after disobeying God for about 300 years under the time of the kings, Samaria was finally taken. Now, Sennacherib tried to take Jerusalem, but as you recall, King Hezekiah went in, fasted, tore his clothes, and prayed, and God caused the army of Assyria to be blinded and leave Jerusalem. But Samaria, the capital of Ephraim and Manasseh, was taken. 2 Kings chapter 18 and verse 9. It came to pass in the fourth year of King Hezekiah, when he was of the seventh year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel. So Hoshea was the king of Israel in Samaria. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it. He came in 721 B.C. At the end of 3 years, they took it, even in the sixth year of Hezekiah, that is the ninth year of Hoshea, king of Israel, and Samaria was taken. The king of Assyria carried away Israel into Assyria, put them in Hala and Habor by the river of Gonad, Gozan, in the cities of the Medes. Now that today is Iraq. It's amazing that Iraq and Iran were the areas where our ancestors, the sons of Joseph, the sons of Ephraim, Manasseh, and the other Israelitish tribes, except for Judah and Benjamin and most of Levi, they were carried away into a land where American soldiers are today once again fighting a war. Because they obeyed not the voice of the Lord their God, but transgressed the covenant. Now the covenant we just read the conditions of back in Leviticus chapter 26. They would be taken for a period of seven times or 2,520 years into this time of captivity. Now, very simple. You simply take 718 B.C., add 2,520 years, you come very much on to about the year 1800. This simple addition, most all of us can do that. So we know when these guys went to captivity. We know the punishment duration-wise was 2,520 years. So we arrive at the year 1800 as the beginning of the last times, or these latter days, these end times referred to in Genesis chapter 49 and verse 1, begin when this covenant is remembered by God and he brings these people out of captivity and begins to bless them according to the promises of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, just like he had said. Now that was the birthright promise, the promise of the great blessings. And we have all been blessed to live in the era of these end times when these incredible blessings have been showered on the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh. Now our nation today is far more cosmopolitan. We like to use the modern term of, what's it called, multicultural. But certainly back in the beginning years, the founding century or so of this country, the descendants would have been far more primarily descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh. And of course, Britain was certainly the descendants of Manasseh or Ephraim for the most part. Now that's calculation number one, that God always gives us a second way to know when these end times begin. Let's go to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7. Never forget that on any important point in the Bible, any important point of doctrine or understanding, God always gives us two witnesses because that's the requirement he gave for us, and he follows his requirements himself. Daniel chapter 7 and verse 1. We have here this first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Daniel had a dream in his visions of his head on his bed. So Daniel's laying down. Daniel's in captivity. He's in ancient Babylon, not long before it fell. And he has this dream. He wrote the dream out and told us some of the matters. I'm sorry. Daniel had a dream. Okay, verse 2. Daniel spoke and said, I saw in my vision by night. I should have brought my glasses, but I forgot them, so I'm trying to make sure. You have to get the exact right distance, and I'm determined that that distance is the distance of my computer monitor. That's the only distance my eyes work anymore, one of the unintended consequences of getting modern-day computers. He says, I saw by vision by night, and behold, four winds of the heavens drove upon the great sea. Four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse from one another. Now, what we find here in chapter 7 is God is simply building on the statue that was pictured in Daniel chapter 2. These four world-ruling governments, God just doesn't give us all the details at once. First, it's pictured as this statue that eventually will be destroyed by the coming of this diamond that comes out of the heavens that becomes the kingdom of God that consumes all those kingdoms. So now Daniel wants to know more details about these four world-ruling governments. So in this dream, God gives us more detail. We're still talking about the same four beasts, the four governments, but now we have more detail in chapter 7. And as time goes on in the book of Daniel, God gives us even more detail. And then, of course, more beyond that in the book of Revelation. So verse 4, the first was like a lion, typifying Babylon. Verse 5, the next is like Persia, typified by a bear. Verse 6, then we have this leopard typifying the Greek Empire. And finally in verse 7, I saw in the night vision, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, strong exceedingly. It had great iron teeth, devoured and broke in pieces, and stomped at the residue of the feet of it. So the Roman Empire absorbed the Persian, the Greek, and what was left of ancient Babylon. It was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. In other words, 10 successive Roman governments that would rule. I consider the horns, is thinking, what are these horns? And there came up among them a little horn. Now this is really strange. You have this massive beast with these 10 horns, and in other places it says they also have crowns upon them, showing there are different rulers, different time periods of ruling, not just 10 ruling at once. That actually comes later at the very last of the 10 horns. So here we have these 10 horns, and up among them comes a little horn. He's kind of bouncing around among these other horns. This would make a good cartoon, but here comes this little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. Okay, so we have these horns, but the first three are plucked up by this little guy. He pulls them all up by the roots, and he kind of garners them together, and the 7 horns that come later, they aren't bothered. So now we have these 10 horns that appear. A little horn appears among them, and he plucks up the first three. And it says, behold, in the horn, in this horn, his eyes are like a man, so he looks like a man, the horn does, but his mouth speaks great things, great blasphemous things, really. So here's this mouth speaking blasphemous things. And I beheld till thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit. So he says, I saw these horns, and at the very end of these horns, the Ancient of Days comes to sit. Well, that gives us an idea of this little horn coming up and these successive governments. Now, the explanation of this is later in the chapter. Let's go down to verse 17. These great beasts, which are four kings, which are going to be on the earth. They shall arise out of the earth. Okay, four world-ruling governments. So they are the same as were typified by the statue back in chapter 2. Fairly simple. The saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and ever. So these four world-ruling governments are temporary. They're going to be replaced by the saints of the Most High that will possess the kingdom of the earth forever and ever. Then I would know the truth about the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the other. He said, well, this fourth beast that was so big, had all these horns, had this little horn that came up and plucked up three. Daniel says, well, what about that beast? I want to know more. He was exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and his nails of brass, which devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with his feet. And I wanted to know more about the 10 horns that were on his head and of the other which came up, the little guy, and came up and before whom three fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. So, what is the explanation of this little horn that the angel gives him? It's in verse 21. I beheld at the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. So this little horn that comes up and plucks up three makes war against the saints and prevails against them until the Ancient of Days comes and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High. In other words, they have deliverance from the Ancient of Days. Now, when did this happen in prophecy? If you look at the resurrections of the Roman Empire fell in 476 AD for the final time. Rome was overrun by Alaric and some of the barbarian tribes, first in 410, some date the end of the Roman Empire as being 410. The final end of the descendants of the Caesar seems to be in 476 when it was kind of completely burned, sacked, destroyed, and Romans were moved to other parts of the world. But at any rate, after that, there began to be these smaller sort of governments from Rome, the Heruli, the Ostrogoths, and some of the other barbarian tribes, the first three. And they did a pretty poor job of trying to manage what had been a stable part of the world for a century. But because of Attila the Hun and the destruction of the Roman Empire and dividing it up, it was absolutely the beginning of the Dark Ages. Beginning in about the year 526, the emperor in the east, which means Constantinople, the Eastern Roman Empire was headquartered in Constantinople. The Western Roman Empire was in Rome, even though it wasn't much of an empire. But Justinian, the king in the east, he built this fabulous palace that was later turned into a mosque called the Hagia Sophia. He decides, I'm going to reunite east and west. I'm kind of tired of this, you know, back and forth. The barbarians are overrunning northern Europe and Gaul. We're losing all of our possessions. If the Roman Empire wasn't broken in half, if it was back together, then we could once again rule the world. So Justinian goes back over to Rome in about the year 538. And in 538, Justinian made a deal, not with any of the kings, but with the Pope. The Roman Empire, the Roman Church, had just become established and had taken over as a force of stability in a very chaotic world. And they had begun to organize themselves on the model of the ancient Roman Empire. They had a prelate, the Pontifex Maximus. They had College of Cardinals. They began to then have diocese and control over much of what they call the Christian world. And Justinian understood that the kings were pretty small, and in fact, the Pope had pretty much dominated them. And so then Justinian makes this political deal with the Pope that they would co-rule, that Justinian would help the Catholic Church rule Europe wherever they needed him, and they would agree to unite and become one big, huge Roman Empire again under Justinian. And so in the year 554, he proclaims this reunited Roman Empire. It's called the Imperial Restoration of the Roman Empire. Now, guess what the Pope had as his requirement? that anybody who doesn't believe like us is going to lose their head, or at least be pulled apart by pieces on the rack. And so we have then this little horn that came up among the third, after the first three, who subdued the first three, said many blasphemous things, proclaiming himself to be the vicar of Christ and other things, and then made this agreement with Justinian that they would do each other's dirty work and control the world. Now, that would never happen in our time. Couldn't happen again, I'm sure. I'm just sort of being facetious because the prophecy showed that it essentially will happen again. But at that point then, the reign of Justinian took control of Rome, made this power-sharing agreement with the Pope. And this is also a beginning of 1,260 years of the captivity of the church, or persecution of the church is a better way to put it. Let's go back to Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12. Now, in Revelation 12, there are two separate three-and-a-half-year periods mentioned. Don't get them confused as being one and the same. They're not. There's one that is during the Middle Ages and one that is at the three-and-a-half years at the end of time. Revelation chapter 12, let's begin in verse 4, talking about the great dragon. His tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven and did cast them to the earth. The dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered and to devour her child as soon as it was born. So Satan the devil tried to kill the Christ child as soon as he was born. She brought forth a man-child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. This is back, of course, this is the real Christmas story, although it's not a mass. This is the birth of Christ story. And her child was caught up by God to his throne. Okay, 31 AD, 32 AD, along in there, 31 AD, very likely. Okay, the woman fled into the wilderness. That was after the time of the restoration by Justinian and the agreement with the Pope that they would do each other's bidding and that all Christians had to conform to the dictates of the Catholic Church. So she fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared of God that they should feed her there 1,260 days. And as Mr. Armstrong mentioned many times, there was a famine of the word. There was almost no preaching of the real truth that went on in any sort of scale that you could measure around the earth for 1,260 years. Because coming out and saying you didn't believe quite like the Mother Church meant you could be killed, you could be punished, you could be thrown in prison or punished in dungeons. And so God fed the church in the wilderness for 1,260 years. Notice there was a war in heaven. Verse 7, Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels and prevailed not. Neither was their place found any more in heaven. Now, Michael is called the Prince of Israel. One understanding of this verse is that at about the time of the end of this 1260 years, which would be from 538 until 1798, or about the year 1800, one understanding is that Michael, the king of the Prince of Israel, was able to prevail spiritually and then allow the blessings of Abraham to be given to the nations of Israel. The book of Daniel shows us clearly there are spiritual elements involved in nations and that many of the events on the earth are frankly being controlled by high spirits in high places. But Michael was able then to, whatever, defeat the restraining influence that had been preventing the blessings on the sons of Ephraim and Manasseh. And that took place at the end of this 1,260 days, or about the year 1800. So we had this end times then beginning in about the year 1800, 1,260 years after they were sent into this captivity or into the wilderness, because this little horn that spoke blasphemous things was using the power of the sword, you might say, or of the government to persecute God's people. And if you look at what happened politically, In the last 20 years of the 1700s, the Church of England lost its grip on America. The Catholic Church lost its grip on most of Europe because of Napoleon and the French Revolution. And from that time forward, missionaries were able to go through all the earth. We had people going, I mean, people of all sorts of you know, Bible-thumping sorts went all over the world. It really didn't happen before that. Well, there were a few, I know there were a few missionaries, you know, in Russia. There were a very, very few down in South America. But since the time of 1800 and the blessings of Joseph being given on the descendants of Joseph, we've also seen this stranglehold of the established church of Europe being loosened or removed for most of the world so that the truth of God could go out. And of course, there have been some, you might say, some misunderstanding of Christianity preachers that have gone out too, but that's part and parcel, because that's what Satan always does, and that's pretty much what always happens. So at the end of this 1260 years, we have the angel Michael, the prince of Israel, as he's called, is able then to loose the bands of Satan the devil in a spiritual sense, so these blessings can then happen to the people of God. Now, there are obviously some parallels at the end time. We don't have time to go through all of that. But both of these evidences show that the end times of Genesis 49 begin in about the year 1800. They follow the chronology of the history of Israel in the covenants and their 2520 years, and also this little head that comes up among the time of the Roman Empire. Now, what is next? It's all well and good to say we know when these latter days or these end times of Genesis 49 are, that we've been living in them, we've been enjoying the lavish blessings that God has given to his people Israel, we've been part of spreading the gospel all over the earth. We've been able to preach the truth, and God has called people throughout the earth. If it wasn't for that, Mr. Mickelson would stay here and be your pastor instead of going over to Africa all the time and all these other places. But God has called people in Africa, and we really do pray and hope that God will send workers. The church has tremendous needs. Places like the Philippines, Mr. Makareg's got like 18 congregations. You know, one man's doing it all. I mean, there is such a need overseas for ministers who can teach the truth and have our smelly, dirty feet called beautiful because we preach the gospel. I mean, those needs are probably more acute today than they have been in any experience that we've had. So there is a real benefit, but there also are some real needs that need to be fulfilled. I'm just thankful that there are men who are able to do that. But let's go back to Genesis chapter 32. Genesis 32. This may be a... You know what? I'm wrong. It's a typo. Deuteronomy 32. Can't be Genesis. Deuteronomy 32. Yes, Deuteronomy 32. This is the Song of Moses. This is Moses' last warning to the people of Israel. He told them over and over and over about God's covenant, about what their requirements would be, and what they had to do if they wanted to attain God's blessings, keep them, and then make them forever a part of the land of Israel. In Genesis chapter 32 and verse 9, as he's saying goodbye to these people, so to speak, he's inspired by God to sing this song. He actually put it to music. We don't have the music, but we can assume that it was one people could sing and then memorize. It's easier to memorize words if you have a song and notes written to them. The Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. So Jacob would have the inheritance of God. He found him in the desert land, in the waste, howling wilderness, led him about. He instructed him, and he kept him as the apple of the eye. So God kept Israel as the apple of his eye. As an eagle stirs up her nest, fluttered over her young, spread abroad her wings, and takes them, and bears them on her wings, so the Lord alone did lead them, and there was no strange God with him. So God brought them out on eagle's wings, even as he says he will do again at a later time. Verse 13. He made them ride on the high places of the earth, that he might eat the increase of the fields, that he made him to suck honey out of the rock, and oil out of the flinty rock. Now, verses 13 and 14 describe a blessing in the future. Keep in mind that when this is written, Moses is about to die on Mount Nebo. He didn't go into the promised land. He is simply reiterating here the blessings of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that would someday be fulfilled. Perhaps the best understanding of this is that it's dual, and it applies to the fact that the people of Ephraim, Manasseh, and the descendants of Joseph are today receiving these blessings, because in this Song of Moses, he's projecting into the future the way things are going to be, that God would make those descendants right upon the high places of the earth. Verse 14, butter of kine, so lots of cattle, milk of sheep, fat of lambs, rams of bread, of Bashan, goats, with the fat of kidneys of wheat, so lots of produce of agriculture and of all sorts of livestock. They did drink the pure blood of the grape, so blessings of wine and of the grape. Notice verse 15, during this time of great blessings, but Jeshurun, which is a name for Israel, is kind of a nickname for Israel. So Israel, the descendants of Israel, waxed fat and kicked. They kicked against God. You are waxing fat. You are grown thick. You are covered with fatness. Then he forsook God, which made him, and lightly esteemed the rock of his salvation. There is no more difficult temptation to weather than success. Prosperity and blessings are the greatest temptation anyone can have. The history of people who have been greatly blessed by God is sad, because we begin to forget God and we begin to think we did it ourselves, and before long, God's no longer in the picture. Remember what Paul said, you know, I'm strong when I'm weak, when God's strength can be seen through me. So the great blessings that America has had have caused us perhaps to lose sight of God. And of course, it says here, they lightly esteemed the rock, that rock that symbolized the presence of Jesus Christ in Joseph during these last days. They have lightly esteemed that rock of salvation. They provoked him to jealousy with strange gods, with abominations, provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to devils, not to gods, to gods whom they knew not. So this is all being said in advance of what they would do. Verse 18, of the rock that begat you, you are unmindful. You know, how many people have observed that we are a nation that has forgotten God, that the modern-day descendants, especially over in Ephraim, the modern nation of Britain, there's almost no one even mentions God or the Bible. It's almost like a nation of completely atheistic people, except, of course, for the Muslims that have moved in who are rapidly taking over much of the country. Or of the rock that begot you, you are unmindful and have forgotten the God that formed you. So God said, I'll hide my face from them, verse 20, and we'll see what their end shall be, for they are a very froward generation and children in whom is no faith. They have provoked me to jealousy with that which is God, not God. They have provoked me to anger with their vanities. So here God is very simple, very plain, that there is going to be a time of punishment after they have been blessed. Notice verse 23. I will heap mischief upon them. I will spend my arrows upon them. They shall be burnt with hunger and devoured with burning heat. With their destruction, I will also send the teeth of the beasts upon them, with the poison of serpents and of the dust. So in this time, which is during the time of great blessings that we've experienced since the year 1800, people would forget God, and God would once again have to punish those people. Verse 25, the sword without, terror within, shall destroy both the young man and the virgin, the suckling also, and the man with gray hairs. Of course, some of us that don't have much hair don't have to worry about that, even though what's left are gray. I said I would scatter them into corners. I would make them remembrance of them to cease from among men. Were it not that I feared the wrath of the enemy, lest their adversaries should behave themselves strangely, and lest they should say, our hand is high, and the Lord has not done this. So God says, I will not allow them to be completely destroyed, but I will allow them to be scattered, but only enough to where their enemies can't boast, because they still have to understand that God has done it. Verse 28, for they are a nation void of counsel, neither is there any understanding in them. And we could give many, many examples of that today. Oh, that they were wise. You know, God would want us to be wise. God would want the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh to be wise. But he said, oh, they're not. Oh, that they were, that they would consider their latter end. Consider the final end of all of these things that they're being taught. You know, that really is the only choice we have today. We can't stop the process of the history of Israel. We can understand it from a prophetic standpoint, sort of a macro view, so to speak. We can understand the truth about the latter days. All we can do, though, is consider the last days of ourselves. We can consider our latter end in verse 29. You know, one of the rules of success is to begin with the end in mind. And of course, the end of our life should be a success of following God, where God would look at us in the resurrection and say, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Well, what is happening, obviously, is that we live in a land that is forgetting God and is being defiled. We are in the process of going through the next phase, which is the decline of the land of these blessings. And it ends up over in Jeremiah chapter 30, which is a time called Jacob's trouble. Now, the trouble is brought on because people are disobedient. The trouble is brought on because we have allowed perversion and all the sins of Leviticus 18 that have been called out by God as being the reason why the land is defiled. Adultery, homosexuality, murdering our children through abortion, all of those things defile the land. And so eventually God will have had enough. And in Jeremiah chapter 30, he says in verse 5, "Alas, for the day is great, so there's none like it. It is a time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out from it." Now, the last time Jacob had trouble, go back to the 700s BC, when Samaria was besieged by Assyria, they really weren't saved out of it. They were taken to captivity. This couldn't refer to that because, frankly, it's written afterwards anyway. But this time of Jacob's trouble, in this time, he's going to be saved out of it, not because of the righteousness of our physical nation, but because of a people that God says, if it weren't for his elect, that the entire earth perhaps would disappear. So for the sake of God's promises and that spiritual nation he wants now to raise up and is in the process of raising up, this time of Jacob's trouble that's coming will be short-lived, it won't last long, and we shall be saved out of it. In verse 8, it says, "It shall come to pass in that day, says the Lord of hosts, I will break his yoke from off your neck, will burst off your bonds, and strangers shall no more serve themselves of him." So when Jacob then, when the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh and the other descendants of Jacob go into this last time of punishment and captivity, Christ himself is going to return and remove that yoke, remove that captivity, and restore those people back to that land in a restored condition. This is not the same process they went through in the 700s BC or the years after that. This can only refer to a time that is yet in the future. It's interesting that Moses even understood this. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 30. This entire history of Israel and these end times that we are now living in was prophesied a long time ago. Moses understood exactly what the history of these people would be. And of course, it's come to pass just like he said. The important thing is for us to understand our part, that we are now a part not only of a physical nation perhaps, but far more importantly, a part of a spiritual nation. That he who is a Jew is one inwardly, and God is now building a spiritual nation, that in one day he'll bring that nation to pass and have it resurrected or brought up at one time. In Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 1, it says, "It shall come to pass when all these things are come upon you." This is Moses speaking. "So when all these things have happened to you, the blessing and the curse which I have set before you, and you shall call them to mind among all the nations where the Lord your God has driven you." So he knew that eventually God would drive them into all nations because of their sin. "And you'll think about it. And you shall return to the Lord your God and shall obey his voice according to all that I command you this day, you and your children with all your heart and with all your soul." I really think this is referring to the time of the first few years of the millennium, when Christ returns and people begin then to come out of that captivity and reestablish themselves back in the land of promises. Verse 3, "Then the Lord your God will turn your captivity and have compassion upon you and return you and gather you from all nations where the Lord your God has scattered you. And if any be driven out to the outermost parts of heaven, from thence will the Lord your God gather you, and from there he will fetch you, from the uttermost parts of the earth. And the Lord your God will bring you into the land which your fathers possessed." So back into the land where their fathers used to live. This could not refer to the first time they crossed the Jordan and came to live in the promised land. But they're going back to a land that their ancestors possessed. So it has to be much, much later in the future. "You shall possess it. He will do you good and multiply you above your fathers." So the land will be even more productive. It'll be even more blessed and more fabulous during this second habitation than it was during the first. The second kingdom there will be far greater than Solomon's kingdom. And the splendor and the gold and the produce and the cattle and all the good things, far greater than anything Solomon or David ever thought of. "The Lord your God will circumcise your heart." So the people of Israel will finally have soft hearts. They will want to seek their God. And that hardness of heart, that stubbornness that has been, that defiance that has been the hallmark of human nature, and especially of the Israelitish mind, will finally be softened and removed. and the heart of your seed, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, that you and all your soul, that you may live. This is the greatest commandment. All of Israel will someday finally keep the greatest commandment. And you shall return to obey the voice of your Lord and do all his commandments, which I command you this day. So there's a very difficult time coming, a time as the modern nations who have received these blessings continue to forget God, to resent him, to kick him out, to murder their children, to extol adultery and all of these perversions. God will punish them and scatter them, but they'll be brought then, saved by him and brought back to a land when they can return to God and learn to keep his commandments. The Lord your God will make you plenteous in every work of your hand, in the fruit of your body, in the fruit of your cattle, in the fruit of your land for good, permanently. This is going to be a permanent change. For the Lord will again rejoice over you for good as he rejoiced over your fathers. There will be a time when God will rejoice over the later descendants of Israel, these other people, just like he did over their fathers years before. If you shall hearken unto the voice of the Lord your God to keep his commandments and his statutes, which are written in this book of the law. So guess what book they're going to learn when they return? It's not just the New Testament. It's the entire Word of God. And turn unto the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. For this commandment which I command you this day is not hidden from you. It's not far off. The commandment that God wants us to obey isn't far off. In fact, most of you have it on your lap. Most of you have it on your bookshelf. Most of you have it, maybe a copy in your car. All we have to do is be the first ones, the pioneers, to really apply this book and its teachings in our lives, and we will indeed be the pioneers who led the way during this time of the end times.